Accession number 11928, Rule 1.
Mr. Fraser, Rule 1. Now, you were telling me that you were born in Glasgow. What did your father do for a living?
He was, at the time, a draftsman, and he became an electrical engineer.
Were you educated in Glasgow?
No.
Whereabouts?
In various schools and in London, privately.
What job did you take up when you left school?
I became a student electrical engineer with the City of Nottingham Corporation Department in Nottingham, and it was an arrangement my father came to with the then general manager of the Nottingham Corporation, wherein I would start at the very bottom and work up through the various grades of engineer. And I remember my first day was in the cooker department, where I had to, before they could, anything could be done to these cookers from the houses, they had to be put in a big bath of, I don't know what was in it, but it certainly cleaned them up. And taking them apart, and the cockroaches running all over the floor, and these were how they came out of the houses, and then they went through the various processes of rewired, repacked, and sent out again as as new cookers.
How did your interest in amateur radio start?
That started well back. That started when I was the age of about 6 or 7. I made a crystal set. I think it's some. I used to take the Modern Boy, and I made this crystal set, and I couldn't receive anything. And I thought, well, this is darn funny, and didn't know anybody very much in that side of it, but decided that if I had a more powerful set, I would possibly do better, and I so built one at the age of about 6 or 7, and duly I was able to pick up stuff, just a one valve receiver, and from then on I was making my own super hets and the lot, right through up to the decent stuff where I could get anywhere in the world, and that's when my interest started and carried on.
And what about your interest in painting?
They started about the same time. I was painting and interested in radio from a very, very early age. Those two things.
How did you come to join the Navy?
I was very keen on amateur radio. My German wasn't too bad, and I used to tune in to all the hype speeches that were coming out and emanating from Germany, and I decided that here was a good thing coming, an opportunity for me to volunteer for the Navy. I decided I wanted to join the Navy because I wanted to go to sea and paint. And how can I put it? My family, my father was in the army, by the way, and they hadn't got much interest in me joining anything, I don't think, because I was in a reserved occupation, being employed by the Nottingham Corporation Electricity Department. And one day in December or January 1940, the whole of Nottingham was snowed out. There were no trains running, no buses, nothing. And I walked to Carrington Street, where the recruiting office was, a distance of some 7 miles, snow up to the waist here at times. And I went in to this Congregational Church, which had been taken over as a recruiting office. This petty officer said to me, "What do you want, son?" And I said, "Well, I want to join the Navy." He said, "Well, what are you?" I said, "Well, I work at the Nottingham Corporation Electricity Department." Oh, he said, "Fine. Right, sign here. You'll be a wireman when you've seen the doctor and all the rest of them." And I said, "Well, no, I don't want to be a wireman. I want to be a telegraphist." He says, "Sorry, son, there's no room for any telegraphists." So I said, "Well, thank you, Chief," and made to go in to see the doctor and darted out of a side door and walked 7 miles back to Bramco, where I was then living. And got hold of a pal. I said, "Look, what's a wireman?" He said, "He's an electrician." I said, "Well, I don't want to be an electrician." I said, that's sure. He said, "Well, did you say what you did?" I said, "Well, I worked here." "Ah." And we had a chat. And I saw Jim Cullen that night, who was a great friend of mine, and we did all things together, like amateur radio. There were about four of us. And he said, "Well, you worded it wrongly. You should have said that what you were doing, you were a student electrical engineer, and therefore you wanted to be a telegraphist." So the next day, another 7 miles there, different chief I went to. The other guy was there, and I said, "I want to join the Navy as a telegraphist. I'm a student electrical engineer." He said, "Right, just go in there, see the doctor, eye test and all the rest of it," and that was the answer to it. So I'd done 28 miles of walking through the snow, but I got what I wanted.
Where were you trained?
At Skegness, Royal Arthur. It was Billy Butlin's holiday camp.
What were conditions like there?
Terrible. Oh, yes. Well, you see, we had to condense a year's work into 6 months. So there was no lowering of standards in the Navy. In other words, you had to work twice as long. So we were shaken at 5 o'clock in the morning and worked through twice the time we'd normally work to. We woke at about five and worked through till five. In other words, double the time. And there was one very interesting thing there. It was all work. It was really go, because, oh, there's a very good thing here. This was pushed at you the whole time. When you joined, you were offered a commission. I said, "I don't want a commission, I want to be a telegraphist." Right. Anybody else? And they finally, about 7 or 8, 9, 10 out of a class of 40 left to take up commissions, because they hadn't got a commission in engineering for a short term hostilities only rating. You'd have to be for 12 or whatever years. Hostilities only didn't count. And so I said, "Right, I'll plough on." And they said, "Well, if you fail, you either go as a stoker or a steamer. There is no way back. You cannot take a commission if you fail in this course, because there's too much money gone into training of 6 months, public expense." And, well, that was enough to goad anybody onto any. But I had a little bit of back knowledge, and, which came in useful. But the training was very, very thorough. And every month we had a test, and those that failed, they went to seamen or stokers. And in the end, out of the class of 40, in December 1940, there was only, I think, 9 of us left out of the whole class. And out of those 9, I came out top marks. And that was by giving a lot of time away to shore leave time. And going into, they had a radio room there, and Reuters Press was coming over at night, every night, all night, and they were sending it 30 words, 35 words a minute, and we had to send and receive at 25, and I was able to make good use of that radio room. One of the interesting things is we were in direct line across the Wash for the early Hampton planes on the Ridge coming into Lincolnshire, and of course we got bombed pretty frequently as well ourselves. There was one interesting thing in December before I left. This would be early December. It was very, very cold winter, 46. 40 to 41, I should say, that particular winter. And there were, where they'd been in a chalet, there would be a single chalet. They'd put two double bunks in, and there were four of us in there. And the chief came along this morning, 5 o'clock, knock, 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 wakey, wakey, rise and shine, all the rest of it. The sun's burning your eyeballs out. Sonny's, get out of it, get out. And he flung the blankets off the bloke below me and shook his leg, and the bloke was dead. He died in the night, hypothermia. I mean, they were just wooden chalets. There was no heating in them, nothing. They were younger than I was. I was about 19 at the time, and he was dead. That was it.
Had people complained about the cold?
Oh, I always complained. They tried to give us more blankets, but it was rough. The food was adequate, of course, but it was spoiled by the cooks.
Did they not have stoves?
No, nothing. They were never designed. They might have had them later when I'd left, but at that time, no, nothing. It was just blankets and blankets and blankets.
What month would that have been in?
That was December. December 1940.
What kind of ships did you go on at first?
Let me tell you this. I when I finished training, we were given the choice of a port division, Devonport, Chatham or Portsmouth, and as I rather like Devon, I chose Devonport, being the furthest away from Nottingham as well, see the world a bit in that part. And I went into Drake Barracks, which was HMS Drake on there, and I thought, I don't like this, I don't like big ships, and I don't want to be on a big ship. So I immediately volunteered for, they have what they call stripies. The guys who won't take any leading rate or petty officer, they just wear the good conduct badges, three of them, and they won't accept any responsibility. But do they know the rules and regulations? They are absolutely good. And if you're in trouble, you go and see Stripey. There's always a Stripey of each mess. And he said, well, if you don't want to go on a big ship, son, he said, why don't you go on a big ship? I told him straight. I said, all those pipes and whistles blowing, do this, do that, double here, double there, I don't want that.
You didn't want to be regimented?
No way, no way. No, I wanted to be a two-legged fish. I wanted to be able to paint. And this was it. So he said, well, there's only one thing you can do, is volunteer for trawlers. And that was lowest off Europa. So within a few days I was out and in Lowestoft. And then a draft came along, and I was sent to Portland, and this ship was sweeping for magnetic mines, which they were laying pretty horribly at the time. And we were fixed up with, apart from the usual armaments, the main idea of a magnetic minesweeper was you trailed two cables behind you with DC pulses pulsing at so many seconds as ordered by the Admiralty. Being an engineer, well, not qualified, but a young engineer, I got the idea of the whole thing quite easily. And if the pulse came at the right time over the end of the cable, up would go the magnetic mine, and that was it. And we used to sweep away out of the estuary until the deep water came, and they weren't effective anyway, so that was it. We just returned, and then from there we were sent to Portland, Plymouth from Portland, and we arrived there in time for the heavy raids of 1941. and there were some very heavy raids. They really smashed the town.
On Portland?
There were raids on Portland. There were a lot of oil storage tanks. But
on Plymouth
when we got there, they really did the town. They didn't do the barracks. They did the whole of the houses and the whole of Union Street, the whole lot. They didn't go for the Devonport barracks. Were just up the road, 2 miles. They didn't touch that. They just did the town, smashed it completely. I think they were trying to get at the morale of the people.
How did the morale of people in Plymouth stand up to it?
Very, very well. Yes.
Did you have close contact with the civilians?
Oh yes, we indeed, because we were based when we finished minesweeping, which would take us probably most of the day. We'd come in again for the evening, and then we could go ashore and talk with the locals. There was a certain amount of beer available at the time, so we'd get in the local pubs and chat to the locals about the whole thing.
So did anybody ever say to you that that the bombing was too much and that
they
had to come to an agreement?
No. The attitude was, we'll get them. we'll do him.
So
being Hitler.
There was a feeling to pay them back in their own coin.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Do you remember any specific bombs which caused damage to any particular streets or buildings that you recollect?
Yes, Union Street. There was there was one on I got back off leave and it was prior to this. There was a big raid one night, and there was two stations. There was a north end station or north road station and another one, and they hit this station. I can remember seeing now a couple of carriages go up in the air and concertina and fall down again. They're so close to it. You can just see them now. They just went up, just crashed down. So they caught that station, and at night, we had to go out into harbour. We weren't allowed to stay alongside in Plymouth because of the danger to the ship and the crew. So we all used to go out into the harbour and anchor anywhere. And one night, there was a ship called the Osama. And I've never been able to trace her. She was big as us at the time, and or bigger. And a bomb went straight down the funnel. The raids were over. The plane was just didn't bother to drop it on the town, dropped it on the harbour, and it went straight down the funnel, blew it up. But at that precise time, there was a steward going up to the bridge, and he was blown clear. And a life raft, an inflatable, was blown clear. He managed to get on this, and he was sitting there in the middle of the harbour. The raid was over, shouting, "Mother, mother, mother!" And the guy had gone completely off his rock. I don't know what happened to him, but you know, the shock. I don't think he knew where he was, but as far as we know, he was saved because we picked him up.
How do you spell Osama?
Asama. Asama.
A British ship?
Yeah, British trawler. Another sweeper. But I've never been able to trace her. I've got Jane's fighting ships, war losses, but only up to 1940, so I've not been able to trace any more, but she was definitely sunk.
Which ship were you on at the time?
I was on the Oster at the time, OSTA.
What kind of a ship was she? Can you describe her?
Yes, she was a small trawler of about I would say about 350-400 tons. Crew of about 30, and she wasn't a good sea boat. I mean, she was only suitable for the job she had. She should be classed as a large drifter in seine netting in peacetime, I imagine, herring, and so on. Close inshore boat.
What kind of a crew would she have? Where would they come from, and what would their background be?
Well, they would just be... I think she was an ex-Fleetwood vessel, so she'd just have the ordinary fishing families on board. In charge would be a skipper and his mate, and a WT operator, of course, a radio officer. And the rest just as they picked them up on the quayside, as they did in those days, mostly, they just hired them for a trip.
But some of them would be the original Fleetwood fishermen, would they?
On board us at the time, no. They had been, but our skipper was Hull, and his mate was Hull.
Had they been fishermen in Hull?
Oh, yes, they weren't Fleetwood men, they were Hull men, but it was just how the drafts went in the Navy. They were drafted there. They were R&R, the pair of them. And the rest of the crew were reserves and hostility only, volunteers like myself.
Now, you said you wanted to go to a small ship. Did you find that in practice life on a small ship did suit you?
Yes, indeed, yes. It was rough, it was tough, but you learnt to get on with people, because on a big ship you never met anybody. I know for a fact that it was too much regimentation on a big ship. But on a small ship, you all work with one another. If somebody was broke and couldn't afford to go ashore, you took him ashore.
In what way was it rough and tough?
Well, the conditions weren't very good. Usually the mess decks were swimming with water. This was normal life at sea, but on a big ship, of course, you wouldn't get that. They were drier, let's put it that way, and they had films on board and things like that.
How dangerous was the minesweeping to the ship?
We lost an awful lot, put it that way. I think there were, from what I remember, I got a record of it somewhere. Up to 1940, yes, from 39 to 40, we lost about 75 minesweepers, which was quite a high average of all the comparative with the other vessels.
What were the particular dangers which minesweepers faced? What were the kind of accidents that were likely to occur?
Well, hitting your own mines, weren't only contending with magnetic mines, although I didn't mention this, but you had acoustic mines, you had floating mines, you had all sorts of mines to contend with, and the ordinary horn mine, which floated and was anchored, if you strayed off your sweat path, as they called it, the area that you should travel through for a fault in navigation, you find yourself in one of your own minefields, and I think the loss were like that way. You could lose a ship through an error in navigation of so many degrees either side. The acoustic mines, well, they obviously, that's self-explanatory. On the bow we had a heavy hammer type device attached, and it was rather like a clapper of a bell, and it just sent out these sound waves and exploded the things if they were about. The danger with a magnetic mine, you might go over it yourself before you yourself and the cable had passed over it to blow it up. A lot were lost that way, but we were degaussed, of course. The degaussing device, which all ships had, all small ships anyway, I don't know about big ships, was just a copper coil of wire around the ship, which negated the effect of the magnetism of the ship. In other words, your magnetic potential was nullified with the aspect for the steel. To steal of the magnetic mine.
So why did
a small current was passed through?
So why did the ship blow up on magnetic mines despite the degaussing?
Well, sometime they hadn't had the degaussing. It had to be checked every so often. Sometimes it wasn't checked.
Now, we got up to the Blitz in Plymouth. If you can take me on to what was the next stage in your naval career, please.
Right. I got double pneumonia, and I knew I was going on leave, and I lived for a fortnight with double pneumonia, which takes some bleeding, but it's true, on neat rum. And I managed to get a train to Nottingham, got home, and collapsed in bed, and the local doctor came to see me, and he said, well, this was in 1941, and he said, well, I've got something new here. He said, I'm going to give him an injection with this to either kill him or cure him. And it was, of course, penicillin. And I didn't know that civilians had got it then, but apparently doctors had got it for the forces. So I got a jab of this, and in 3 days I was on my feet again. 3 days from having double pneumonia, just cleared it up like that.
So it had a miraculous effect?
Oh, absolutely, yes, yes. God, I'd never heard of this stuff. But that was that. And then I went back to... got leave from home, went back to Devonport again. Same routine. Had to get a draft to Europa, Lowestoft. And when I arrived there... It was quite uncomfortable. Europa was the actual base was an old theatre, and of course there was no place to hang a hammock. I just slept on the auditorium floor. The chairs had all been taken out, and of course there was this awful slope. But apart from that, the food was pretty bad as well there, and I wasn't there long. And I think possibly it's the only time I've ever ran in my life, actually. Literally ran. The drafting master at arms had called my name and another chap's name, report to the drafting master at arms office immediately, and I actually ran, and I got the Cape Argona. And the other chap who was called, he got another ship. 2 days later, he was in Cardiff Bay, and he and the ship were blown up. I think that's about the only time I ran, apart from action stations, of course, in the whole of my life in the Navy. And I think in this case, it's quite a good idea. But that was the luck of the draw. That happened all the time.
What kind of a ship was the Cape Argona?
She was a hull fishing trawler, about 800 tons, 57 officers and men, and she had been. She was destined for.